Welcome to the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We'll talk to fellow entrepreneurs and share stories of success, failures, and epic failures in the quest to understand the business, art, and science of the indie revolution in the city of big shoulders.
Welcome to another episode of the Chicago Gamepreneur Show. I believe this is an even dozen for us, so big milestone here.
Yay!
Congratulations!
Thank you, guys. I'm here with my host, Rob Lockhart. And Rob, maybe you could introduce guest today.
Sure. So we have Ala Diab and Eve. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on your last name.
No, Tolbert.
It's Eve Tolbert.
Eve Tolbert. Let me start again from the top. Ala Diab and Eve Tolbert, who are working on a really cool project called Planet Lab.
Yes.
And it's on Kickstarter right now. Hint, hint, go back it now.
Thanks, guys.
And it's kind of a game, kind of a platform. It seems like you're doing sort of a pilot game as well as making this platform for teachers to build their own things. Do you want to describe it?
Sure. We built a gamified platform for doing project-based learning in science, technology, engineering, and math, and the arts. So that concept of STEAM integrating design and making and tinkering. And we started out doing a lot of research with 500 CPS students and a lot of STEM educators. And what we found was that there's a lot of really great project-based learning descriptions and lessons and videos and ideas, but that content is kind of spread all over the web, and it's pretty difficult for both students and teachers to find kind of coherent resources so they can put together a project-based learning unit that works as a mission where kids get to do something fun and engaged as well. So our idea was, well, what if we were to invent a game that uses existing materials and uses real-world challenges where kids are learning science, but they're really also helping people in the planet in meaningful ways. So that's the concept of Planet Lab.
Mm. Yeah, it strikes me as like a really great way to get more authentic lessons being made, as well as just like more, as well as it being gamified and more playful and fun.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, I should just want to add a little bit. When we say gamification in this sense, we are using some sort of badging system on the platform, but we're also trying to experiment with both narrative elements and role playing as a way to kind of get people, you know, young learners in this case, engaged, and we kind of have them as repeat users and / players / learners. So it's kind of it's a hybrid kind of game.
So I'm wondering if maybe you could just run me through like a example scenario, something that, you know, me as an educator or me as a student would be, you know, like just do for a one-off.
Sure. So we're developing a project right now with University of Chicago Computation Institute and Project Sincere and Chicago Public Schools facilities to develop this Energy Engineers Challenge. So youth at the middle grade and high school level will do a hands-on project while they'll engineer a smart grid light that actually uses programmable LEDs to show school energy usage. And they'll do a number of challenges that work towards the goal of decreasing school energy usage and helping our carbon footprint, as well as educating their families and their neighbors about how to save energy. And so as they do that, they'll be taking on the role of different kinds of professionals in the world of energy conservation. So what does a lead specialist do in a building? How do they evaluate a building and look for energy leaks? What does a a advertiser do when they're developing a campaign to try to impact behavior change. So they get this chance to role play and this real exposure to different kinds of career pathways as they do something meaningful for their school and neighborhood community.
Very cool.
Some of my favorite games have been, or educational experiences have been, as sort of as simple as that, as just like take on the role of another career that maybe isn't even on the radar in terms of like, you know, the typical kid career paths of like, I don't know, what do they have now? Ballerina, astronaut,
firefighter.
Firefighter, yeah.
Professional sports athlete, yes. Extraordinaire.
Software programmer.
No, well, I think that is a computation.
Maybe.
Yeah.
It depends on what their dad does.
Yeah.
Right.
And their mom.
You know, that's a great point, too, that that's something in social science that's called the reproduction, sort of social reproduction is the social science term for it, that our education system tends to reproduce the same outcomes across generations because we don't think about all that good cultural capital, all that kind of insider knowledge that kids get when they're exposed to the careers of people in their family. And schools really have to work against that current. If we're talking about equity in education, we have to think of how to not just reproduce the same outcomes over and over, but really expose young people to this breadth of career pathways, this sense of what might happen, how they get there. And that's really something we want to build into the design of Planet Lab as we get piloting with CPS schools.
Yeah, so it sounds like through this type of role play, the kids will essentially get that kind of social capital experience, right? Where you actually kind of assume the personality of, you know, someone in a field that you wouldn't necessarily consider by yourself in your own circle.
Yeah,
like
that's
right.
Keeping.
Right, yeah. Right, right, right. Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, why not? I mean, we need bees.
We need bees, yeah. We need
but I mean, early on, we were also kind of, we recognize this kind of tension between do we kind of force feed science missions on the students / players, or do we allow them to self-select? And I think ultimately what we're going to be end up building is sort of a simple algorithm that, you know, has like a weighted percentage of how much you kind of
how related
exactly
is this to previous things,
right? Exactly, and kind of at the same time allow them to explore on their own and assume different identities as scientists.
So mechanically, I'm just curious how it all kind of works together. When you describe it to me, I'm kind of thinking this D&D scenario where instead of a cleric, I'm an engineer or something like that. But I'm just interested in how it would play out in a classroom scenario.
Sure. So, we're working this out, and we'll take this through test cases, working with groups like the Morton Arboretum, CPS facilities in this energy challenge, the Alliance for the Great Lakes. So let's say that you are in your classroom and you get a prompt to look at, as a hydrologist would look at, the urban watershed. So you get a mission. Hey, you know, here's the situation with our water. In Chicago, every time it rains hard, our sewage system overflows our river, and that gets dumped into our lake. And that has to do with the history of how the watershed got designed and how the river got rerouted. So you get presented with this design challenge. So it's not just a set of facts in a science textbook. It's here's something that people are really trying to figure out right now. And then you do some standards in line readings, think about the issue, and then you get the opportunity to participate in an event. So, for example, Alliance for the Great Lakes is already running Adopt-A-Beach Days with lots of schools and districts, about 13,000 youth a year, youth and families. So the prompt will before you're adopted each day, you'll learn more about the watershed protection issues, and you'll have a mobile data collection form so that you can record the trash that you're collecting. And then when you're back in the classroom, you can use that as a design challenge. So how could we, what's a way that we could think of a policy intervention that would reduce cigarette butts on the beach? What's a way that we could think about engineering the way that the water runoff happens after the rain to keep waste out of our lake? So how can we revamp our schoolyard to retain more rainwater so it doesn't all just flow out into the river and the lake? So that kind of sequence of activities, it's not, you know, it's not rocket science. Teachers have been figuring out how to put this together, but usually they're drawing materials from lots of different resources and kind of
And it often gets lost after they use it.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
This will
allow schools are very siloed in
yes.
respects.
Right, and so one cool thing about the citizen science work that we are planning to do is that students will be able to enter data in their scientist role, but then also check out what's happening in other schools and look at some data visualizations of the collective project. So they're part of something that's happening between multiple schools.
Yeah, very neat. Awesome. I like that collaborative aspect. I think it's an important thing that, there's not a lot of support for right now.
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah, we agree.
How long have you guys been working on this?
Almost a year now. As Eve mentioned, we started out with that kind of pilot workshop with 500 youth, and we learned a lot of lessons from it that we incorporated into the initial thinking. And in a lot of ways, the youth that we worked with are our sort of co-designers on this. And so the game part is only one of three main components that, you know, have to kind of sort of work together to make this happen. One of which we're actually building right now, which is the content management system that will help the teachers and mentors and citizen scientists kind of port a lot of the siloed content, scientific content, into a unified format that is Common Core standard aligned and next generation science standard aligned, and that has its own like social ecosystem. So teachers can actually recommend content to each other, and we're going to have a rating system by which the good content, you know, rises to the top, and people don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Nice.
And so sort of, you know, in order
a
for
bit
the
of
game
a Yelp for lesson. Activity
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
We found that a lot of organizations were already borrowing each other's content and rewriting it. And so this is just a way of making that streamlined process interoperable resources.
Right. And we don't want to replicate the textbooks. We want to have enough relevant information to form the basis for the, let's say, upper layer of the game that's going to be the engaging part.
We like to discuss, especially with new products that are coming out, what platforms you're targeting, just as kind of, you know, we like to get an idea of, you know, what people are thinking. If they're thinking, well, we'd like to stick this mostly on web, or we're going to concentrate more on mobile. So what's your thought process in terms of platform and where you want to see it moving?
Sure. That's a great question, actually, because so we're building using a mobile-first strategy, but using AngularJS and making it so that it can really be used across desktop, tablet.
It's responsive.
It's responsive, yeah. And the reason is so I'm a social scientist. My background is in education research and youth development programming, and I was working on a study for 4 or 5 years that looked at learning in the home environment. So we were videotaping hundreds of hours of families in after-school time. And what was really cool was just seeing all these everyday interactions that became platforms for learning. So making pancakes as a platform for learning about chemistry. Or or taking a walk in the evening and bird watching or thinking about how ecosystems work. So part of what we are really aiming for is to be able to engage youth across contexts and not think, you know, that idea of connected learning where you're not thinking of young people only in their role as students or only in their role as kids doing chores in the neighborhood or only in their role as, you know, taking an after-school program, but how young people can access this resource is to look up stuff in a lot of different contexts. So we want it to be something that young people can use on their devices, but that also is teacher-facing in the school environment as well. So there's a lot of design work and figuring out that we have to do as we test with those different audiences.
Yeah, I think, I mean, in the line of work that I do, outside of the game stuff, like mobile is pretty much the default standard now, right? Because people are just so active on their devices all the time. And especially, we've got a new generation coming up that have basically grown up with smartphones.
Right.
And a lot of youth, I think it's just so natural.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. For a lot of youth, it's actually potentially their first computer.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it seems like a lot of your focus is on stuff that happens outside the classroom and outside of, you know, sometimes even outdoors. Like, it doesn't make sense to use Planet Lab in some contexts unless you're on your mobile device.
Yeah. That's
right. Especially if you're doing, like, in-field, you know, data collection and, you know, taking lots of pictures and kind of uploading them, and so the form factor and the device, you know, work perfectly for that context.
So what's your dream for the scope of the project? Like, how big do you want to take it? Are you going to internationalize it, or like,
you know, that's a great question. The dream really is an international dream because, you know, our generation coming up have to face problems that are globally networked. When we think about our carbon footprint and climate change, that's a problem that, you know, we're sending our politicians to discuss, and, you know, Chinese politicians and U.S. politicians are making deals that kick in 20 years from now. How can we really develop, you know, and how can we really use an international platform to develop global citizenship, so that as young people learn about their community and their local ecosystem, they're also learning about these global trends and what their role is in those trends. So that really is the dream. We do have a few content partners signed up from international organizations, the India Wildlife Club, which has really cool content about tigers and
awesome
zoos in India, and Toys from Trash India, which is a great organization that works with waste, you know, straws and pieces of metal and paper clips to really teach fundamentals of engineering using waste. And they've been really successful across India. So they're excited to say, oh, wow, you know, maybe our content could be translated to French. It's already in these three Indian languages in English, but how can we think? So we don't have an internationalization strategy yet. We're really excited to get to launch with CPS schools. But that is the dream. Do you want to say anything more about that?
No, I think we pretty much captured it. We're both excited, and a lot of the people who we talked to are equally excited about the potential of the network effect that, like, a game / app like this would generate, where people just cross-pollinate and kind of exchange ideas across distance.
Some virality.
Not only virality, but also kind of, you know, a little bit of, like, learning from each other's experiences.
I see. In terms of, like, generating the content.
Exactly. So, like, you know, there are solutions that, you know, people, you know, in Africa or India might be able to think about that are kind of tending to their own local needs that can be globalized. And vice versa.
I'll tell a quick story about that. One of my jobs as an anthropologist was to work with kids in Tijuana Tecate who were informal recyclers. So I was doing research on child labor near the U.S.-Mexico border. And I met kids who were studying in school really kind of useless information. Like, you know, one kid showed me her homework and she had to add 21 to itself until she got to 4,000. So 21, imagine a whole page of 21 plus 21. And here's a kid who actually on her weekends is starting to work in the dump as an informal recycler, which is what her parents did and what her community did. And I started to research innovations in informal recycling community development. And there were these great projects in the Philippines where people were starting eco centers and where they had strategies around branding and forming cooperatives that would allow them to work more safely. Strategies for reclaiming waste and using that to do slum upgrading in informal communities. And what I started thinking about was, gosh, these kids going to school in Tijuana could learn more from kids in a similar geography, in a similar situation in the Philippines or in Lagos, but there's no way for them to interrelate and learn STEM together or really think about their community development needs together. Instead, they're learning this siloed national content, which is like, write the textbook, kid, and take a test on these numbers. And so, you know, thinking of that as an opportunity space for the exchange of ideas became a really interesting set of questions.
Yeah, that is fascinating.
Yeah, I've never considered just how easy, like, a distributed platform like this, it makes it to have an international viewpoint. And I think that's really useful because, honestly, I didn't really start thinking in an international viewpoint until I traveled myself, right?
Mm-hmm,
and that
mm-hmm.
was after post-college and stuff like that. And that really expands the way you kind of think about problems, the way you approach the world. And the opportunity to start that sooner, I think, is really important in terms of, you know, just the way the economy and the, you know, global politics in general are changing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So maybe you can walk
us... opens a can of worms about, like, what good are nations in a world with the internet?
And... That's true.
Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Yeah, it's, yes. It's a great set of
That's
questions.
That's a delicious can of worms you got there.
So I was going to ask, like, yeah. in terms of Kickstarter backing, maybe you could just walk us through the levels of backing and what, you know, at different levels, what people can expect.
Sure. We don't have awesome flashy prizes for you at this point in time. At the $20 level, you could be a Planet Lab playtester, so you get a code to be part of the beta launch. At the $40 level, we're going to prepare a design kit, a design manual, and we're going to ask for you or your kid or other young people that you might be working with to contribute ideas for missions and for storylines. And you'll also get an excerpt of a project we're working on, which is a pilot animated sitcom script. So you can give us your ideas and they'll be folded into the design work. At the $75 level, you get that plus a really great looking t-shirt.
There you go. Excellent.
And,
yes.
Yeah, and then we also have designed a prize. We for people doing research that want to take their research into the schools, there's a prize where we can develop out your content in a standards aligned mission. So those are some of the amazing, amazing things.
Yes.
And Planet Lab itself is going to be, what, free or?
Yep. Free, and we're looking at a structure where schools would pay in a small amount per student to be able to track student learning across grade levels, the related science and math, science, literacy, and math concepts, and sort of that standards alignment piece. They'd be able to get more student data.
Right.
That's very nice.
Yeah, that's a big chunk of analytics that we're going to roll out for the paid service. But it's part of our mission to provide equitable access to a lot of communities for this high-quality content that we're producing.
I'm curious on the analytics piece. Have you been collecting any data kind of in the build-up till now? And have you found anything interesting so far? Or is that something where you're kind of expecting data to come in and then you can kind of share it out after that point?
We're seeing in education, you know, we do a lot of educational testing around math and literacy. And we want to offer schools a way to look at the way that they're engaging topics and technology and science and melding data analytics with math and literacy skills, and looking at how students are applying lexicons or specific vocabulary sets around topics that they're learning in science.
Gotcha. I think metrics and analytics are so interesting because oftentimes they uncover hidden data or things that we're kind of blind to because of biases.
Right.
If you look at something like the Sixties Revolution in sports with Moneyball, I think, you know, and Malcolm Gladwell writes a little about this in his latest book, but he says that we have this idea of what a good student is, right? This bias to where a good student is. Whereas some people have the talent, we're just not able to see it. So that's why I'm interested in the metrics, because maybe those metrics can pull out things that we're just not taught to look for.
Right, yeah. Right. You know, how you correlate a certain activity with a location, and like what kind of results come out of that, or what kind of wording do you use to describe a scientific concept? I think all of that we're collecting.
This is a really important topic in thinking about the future of education in the U.S. and equity. We're seeing that we're only graduating 1 out of 5 high school seniors with proficiency in science. About 1/3 are proficient in reading and math. So we're doing really poorly at these basic basic stats. But I think there's something that we're missing too in a lot of our focus on education reform, which is that students start to disengage from school in middle school. So we see slopes in student engagement indicators in 5th and 6th grade. And so I think part of what's going on is that we're testing kids, but kids aren't testing schools. And we're not asking kids, how engaging is your classroom? How bored are you on an average day? And a big part of why we're looking at indicators in 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th grade and seeing, you know, these problems in equity and problems in student performance, I think, is because kids are bored. And school can be really, really boring. So how do we address those things together and collect the meaningful data to look at schools and kids being engaged and then their performance and as interrelated problems?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's a great approach.
It reminds me of, I don't know if you've encountered the book Free to Learn. Let's see, it's by Peter Gray, and it's basically about how the more input into their own education students get, the better educated they get, basically.
Right.
Interesting.
And he uses as an example this particular school in upstate New York that's run entirely democratically. So, like, every faculty member and every student gets an equal vote in, like, for example, hiring. Like,
wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Oh, I'm going to check that out. Thanks for that title recommendation.
Yeah.
Oh, my pleasure. But it sounds like it relates to Planet Lab pretty obviously in terms of, like, you know, if students are able to rate these lessons, then it's exactly the same kind of feedback. I mean,
right.
They might not get the choice of who is introducing them to this content, but but what it is partially up to them.
Absolutely. Right. And part of that also is shifting the location of the teacher from the front of the class and being the lecturer and the knowledge holder to the teacher as a facilitator of teamwork. Teamwork directed towards a learning outcome and a real-world outcome. So if we can help to make that shift, then whether the teacher is interesting or boring is a little less relevant. Then it becomes about, is the challenge interesting? Is the design principle interesting?
So we like to do just a little background on our guests whenever they come on. So I'm curious, you know, how did you get your start and how did you end up at this point where you decided to come up with this product and do the Kickstarter for it?
Well, we've been sort of, in a way, informally kind of thinking about this both apart and together for the past 3 or 4 years. My background is in game design, and before games, I did a lot of design work, and I worked with youth on kind of different kind of design related issues, and so I kind of realized that a sort of education as a mission is sort of integral to how I see design, both in the kind of real world sense, but also in, like, you know, the kind of the digital games arena. So it's something that need, kind of, there is a vacuum there that needs to be filled.
But just like autobiographically, was there something that got you interested in this stuff, or?
Oh yeah. When I was finishing my degree at the University of Southern California, we started working on a few experimental education products around college readiness and college literacy for first-generation immigrant youth living in Southern California. And so it was kind of light, kind of eye-opening for me to kind of experience design from within. Our team would engage with high school kids in kind of game design charrettes, and kind of a lot of the ideas that ended up being used and experimented
game
with.
Game design Tourette's?
Charrettes.
Not charrettes. Charrettes.
That sounds like it could be fun, too, though.
Right. I feel like I have that sometimes. Like, you would be so awesome if...
Do you scream, yeah. do you scream out, mechanics,
beep,
mechanics!
Beep.
Yeah.
That's right.
Leaderboards!
You just have to use it to your advantage, I guess, when you have game design Tourette's. Yeah, and that's actually a project called Future Bound Games, right?
Right, so kind of that whole series of prototypes is now being commercialized and spun off as its own company. Of course, congrats to, you know, USC and the people behind the company, its current form. Plus the wonderful design team that worked on these projects, and so kind of now that I, you know, having had gotten a taste of what that feels like, I want to kind of move to this area of, you know, how can we use games for engagement and for, like, behavioral change, and how do we lower the kind of barrier to entry to science, making it an everyday activity that, you know, kids can engage with, both in and out, inside and outside the classroom.
Very cool. You're actually the second USC alum we've had on this podcast, so
ooh,
hey. You know something right there.
No, who was the first?
Craig Stern, USC.
Oh,
no way.
Cool.
Interesting.
Yep.
Nice.
Cool.
And it's also interesting that he mentioned that, you know, he was dabbling in game design before he was in college, but he also had kind of that revelation moment during his college career that's, you know, game design is really interesting, it's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And it was the same for me as well. So I'm wondering if there's just, like, there's an inflection point in college where, you know, you take that one course and then you decide to become a game designer.
Oh, absolutely. I think once you get a taste of what I like to call like systemic thinking, you know, you start seeing everything around you as things that are, you know, interconnected, and they kind of affect each other. You know, you can't really go back from that.
It's true, yeah. Once you've seen past the Matrix, there's no going back.
Exactly. Nice. Yes, it either has you or you have it. Or
no way, man. I want to get plugged back in. I miss the taste of steak.
Yeah, exactly. You're missing that medium rare.
So one of the focuses we have on the podcast is finances. How have you been funding the development of the project up till now? And then, like, what are you going to do with your Kickstarter cash?
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
So we won a few little design awards. We won some hackathons at the early stage. Chicago has...
Congratulations.
Thank you. Chicago has a great civic technology and hackathon kind of scene. So we won... Center for Neighborhood Technology Sustainability Apps Hackathon. That was an early iteration. And then we won some funds from the world through the World Wildlife Fund for the City of Chicago Clean Web Challenge. And that, so we've been bootstrapping, and that just has gone to pay for some of our expenses. And then the Kickstarter funds will go towards our incredible front-end developer, Andy McGinnis, to really be able to put in the hundreds of hours of work that we still need to complete on the content management system front-end. And we're looking at a structure that will allow us, we're thinking about something like Mozilla Corporation, which is a foundation that owns a company, because we want to think of how we can cycle benefits back to the organizations that are creating missions. Yeah, exactly. And so that, but we'd also be able to be a corporation that could sell equity. So we're thinking of this structure that will let us do that. That might be TMI on the finances side.
No, it's very interesting, actually. We've never had someone bring that particular business model in, so it's very interesting to hear about it.
Yeah, there's really cool stuff happening in the social enterprise and social impact space, but a lot of it involves, you know, having a, we have a great legal eagle on our board who's helping us think through some of this, how to do a corporate structure that allows you to be kind of a hybrid between the nonprofit and the for-profit space.
Very cool.
Have you worked out how you're going to do this feeding back into the organizations? Like, I imagine one scenario could be like, how many bits are in whatever you've uploaded? And then that's like shares in...
Or, oh, nice. I don't know. Yeah. Well, part of it is, you know, could we use this kind of a model to redistribute funds towards schools and programs that are under-resourced? So that's called a kind of like a cross-subsidization model. Can you figure out a way to arrange your financial strategy so that you're able to create benefit for programs that need it? So we don't have that worked out yet. We have some really great advisors in that business social enterprise consulting space helping us figure that out.
Nice.
Yes.
So question, you mentioned before that Chicago has this really good like civic hack space.
Yeah.
If I was new to it and I wanted to get involved, what's the best way to get dip my foot in the water?
Easy. Go to OpenGov.
OpenGov Hack Nights. They're on Tuesdays at, I believe at 6 p.m. at the Merchandise Mart. 8th floor, I believe the
1871, 12th floor.
No, they moved down to you can't miss it. Just Google Chicago OpenGov Hack Night. That's the mecca.
There's also Adler has a youth hackathon.
Yeah.
Right. Program, that's part of a different kind of hackathon scene that is more science centered.
Well, they have multiple things. That they have a science hack day at the Adler, and they have youth civic engagement.
Yeah.
There's also the Smart Chicago Collaborative, which runs I think a monthly meetup, and that looks at, you know, a lot of issues in equity and technology access and the way it impacts the city.
Of course, 1871 is you know, has been indispensable in that scene. But the nice thing about it is that they're sort of popping up all over town. There's a Blue 1647, and there are other
co-working spaces.
Co-working spaces that both have, you know, they're trying to kind of grow their own acumen,
like an incubator,
but also provide the infrastructure. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
One more, I'll also plug, since we were part of it, the Center for Neighborhood Technology Sustainability Apps Hackathon, which will be over the weekend of June 5th through 7th this year, in partnership with Microsoft and at the Tech Nexus space in the West Loop.
Very cool. Well, we'll try to get the links up on our site and our Twitter so people can check that out if they're interested. So,
great.
Cool.
Very neat stuff. So we do like to kind of get the gauge the temperature of the Kickstarter. How are things going? I know you're probably into kind of the mid, like, slump area, so things may be quiet, but how do you feel things have
gone
so far?
That everyone gets.
Yeah, literally everyone who's done the Kickstarter wanders into the trough. So.
Right. We've been told about the flat line like around the middle of the campaign, but we're sort of like on our last week stretch right now, and we're 78% funded. So we're gonna.
It's looking good.
Yeah, it's looking great.
Yeah, 78 going in the last week. I think that's great. So
yeah, I think we're gonna survive this one.
How's it been? Like we like to ask, you know, the Kickstarter vets. Has there anything that has surprised you about the Kickstarter? Something that you didn't expect that was very different than what you were planning?
That's a tough one, actually. I have been surprised by the generosity of friends and family, which is sort of maybe goes counter to the kind of traditional wisdom, traditional Kickstarter wisdom of like spread wide and thin as opposed to like narrow and deep. But yeah, I mean, that's my two cents for now.
Well, I mean, I think anyone who's done, you know, a Kickstarter of any size has noticed that those few donors that give the big donations really help. So
yeah, God bless them.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it's literally can be worth, you know, hundreds of times the amount that other people are giving. I mean, not that those people are worth any less, but just like in terms of getting you to the finish line.
Absolutely, and just like, you know, keep the pressure. Like tell everyone, and tell, you know, ask them to tell, you know, everyone they know, and you know, you never know when you're gonna hit the jackpot.
Yeah,
I think people sometimes underestimate how much like the small grassroots stuff matters.
Mm-hmm.
But just even, you know, messaging your Facebook friends and saying, hey, we still got this thing going. If you could just tell everyone you know, that's a lot more effective than people would think, because you're basically talking with your closest friends when
exactly.
you do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I strongly agree with this, and it kind of allowed me to kind of reconnect with friends on my network that I haven't reached out to in a long time, and, you know, kind of have them, you know, be curious about, you know, the project, and it formed a kind of an interesting new bond between us because of the project and the Kickstarter as a backdrop.
Mm. Yeah, I realize that there's a kind of division between Kickstarter projects. You've got the kind of sexy merchandise projects, like men's underwear with this hidden zipper pocket, or, you know...
Whoa, I didn't hear about that.
I know.
Literally
that's
sexy.
That's our next product. No, I'm just kidding.
Or this great... LED display that will make your flat screen TV light up. And those are products that, you know, people are just going to buy because they want them, you know, but it's a little trickier when you have something that's just like, we're building this really awesome free thing and we want you to be involved. It's a little bit more of the PBS sell. So
right. We're building a tote bag.
So you've got to kind of work the message, I guess, a little bit more when you're in that space. But
it's a cause, right? So people are donating to the cause.
Yeah, mm-hmm, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's a cause, exactly.
Yeah, never underestimate the power of a good cause to or story to kind of sell. I think Rob's Kickstarter is a great example of that. People really kind of united behind the idea of it. So.
It's great.
Yeah, it's an inspiring project.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, guys. So
I mean, now we just got to figure out how to integrate the Codemancer into, you know, this bigger framework. So
into
maybe we'll have a badge.
Into Planet Lab, exactly.
Codemancer badge.
Oh boy, it happened again.
Planetmancer. Yeah. Ooh.
We kind of heard your history, Ala. What about you?
Sure.
How did you get into this? Space. You did education grad program.
So I've done a real mix of things in education. I've developed literacy programs and family literacy programs, literacy programs for homeless youth transitioning into jobs, working, like I mentioned, on the U.S.-Mexico border was really transformational in seeing the way that education was really kind of failing to meet the needs of kids in informal economies. And that's really when I started getting interested in education and development together. But I'd also been doing arts integration work, training teachers to use play in the classroom, integrated into curriculum. So that arts integration work was using a lot of theatrical games and role playing. And awesome. So somewhere in that mix is the kind of let's get every kid in the world figuring out how to, you know, work on people on the planet together. Just a slightly big, audacious goal.
And how are those kids in Tecate going to, in Tijuana, going to get at Planet Lab?
So that was really interesting. So, you know, developing world contexts have, you know, not the same kind of tech access that schools in the U.S. have. It's not one-to-one devices, but there is a computer lab, and, you know, teachers are still regularly interacting with the internet to,
nice,
you know, find content. So, and then there's also the rise of mobile, you know, so now they're, you know, lots of kids who live in slum economies and houses made of tin still have mobile phone access. And now we're looking at, you know, mobile web being, you know, these cheap phones, Firefox phones. So it's pretty exciting. And actually, yeah, in developing world context, people are getting phones and mobile service before they're getting clean water. So that's an interesting predicament. How do you leverage one?
I had heard that, but I, for some reason, kind of associated with, like, feature phone.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
I didn't think about, like, sort of being able to browse the modern web on a mobile device that in the, you know, in the developing world.
So in right. rural, in rural communities, in some communities, people use their feature phones a lot more to access, like, the slimmed down version of Facebook to do that kind of messaging. But also these new innovations around web ready phones that are getting really cheap, like $20, will be changing that landscape. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Firefox has been actually kind of working heavily on developing these very affordable multi-touch web driven or web technology enabled phones, then they've been licensing their operating system for third-party manufacturers.
Because they want to solve this problem. They want to get people who have, you know, little web access to be able to have a cheap web browser computer in their hands.
That's great.
Yeah.
You don't have to wait for the Google balloons.
Oh, my God.
Google balloons. So we are rolling up on maybe getting toward the end of the pod. So we do have one reoccurring segment that we do.
Oh, okay.
One reliably reoccurring.
Yeah, that's segment. I forgot if we... Do we have a sound for it? I don't remember if we have a sound for it.
No, we don't have a sound for it.
All right.
Maybe we'll make one.
We can make
we'll
a sound.
We'll figure out a sound eventually. But anyway.
Oh, nice.
Okay.
There we go.
More sound Tourette's, huh? So the segment is called What We're... And it's basically we like to share, you know, what we've been reading, what we've been watching, and, you know, how it's inspiring us to do our work. So
we'll start so that to not put you on the spot.
Ooh, I'm nervous.
Okay, let's see. I've been listening to Life of Pi.
Huh, very interesting.
So, book on tape because, you know, I've been doing car commute. Which I find incredibly boring unless I have something to occupy myself. And I had picked up the book years ago, just read the first page and said, like, this is not for me. but my wife really loves it, so I gave it another shot, and I'm really enjoying it. And it's funny that you mentioned, like, Indian zookeeping.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's, like, precisely what the book is about.
Right.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. in a lot of ways, because it, I don't know, I think people find it to be like very spiritually satisfying book. It does have a lot of like it talks a lot about religion, and the main character is Hindu, Muslim, and Christian.
Right.
Yeah. That's right.
Which causes some problems, but not for him, just for people around him who don't understand, I guess. But you know, as someone who is very interested in religion, and a non-believer, I find it maybe even more interesting, because there really are things about each of those religions that conflict with one another.
Right, right.
And I guess it's fine. Like early in the book, he's just a kid, and he's like in the earliest stages of each of these traditions, and you know, probably hasn't read the whole Quran or the whole Bible, or the whole Bhagavad Gita or whatever. So it's understandable that like he doesn't see a conflict, but I don't know that it's. I'm interested in like what happens later. Like he references like, all of these deities as he's, you know, going through his ordeal, which is what most of the book is about, where he's a castaway. But I want to know what happens after, and I have a feeling that the answer will be nothing.
I mean, have you seen the movie?
I haven't seen the movie.
Okay,
no.
I'm not going to tell you then.
I love the book, actually, and I think to me, I don't want to do a spoiler here because it's
don't
actually one of my favorite
it, no.
books, but you know, I think that what it to me it's sort of deconstructing religion as, you know, this kind of architecture of you're this or this or this, and it's saying, hey, we're in an eternal struggle to survive in an ecosystem, and that has a story, people.
Right. I think the boat metaphor is very aptly described.
Yeah,
this kind
the
of...
world is a boat, and you know, you struggle to survive, and you relate.
Yeah, and your neighbors are unfriendly.
Right.
At least at first.
Right.
No, they stay unfriendly until the end. No, I'm just kidding.
It's their nature.
It's funny that you mentioned Life of Pi, because it's actually a movie I kind of saw in the middle of my Kickstarter trough.
Oh, no. Wow.
You know, when you were at sea yourself.
There I was, alone in the Kickstarter trough on my raft with, you know.
Oh, wow. With a tiger and
hey.
A...
Yeah, you got
it. But really, you know, there's a good message about... just the importance of seeing like the optimistic side of things, right?
Right.
Yeah.
There's power in seeing, you know, when you look at a certain situation, you can always choose to look at it from optimistic or pessimistic point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's good that can happen, you know, just from even in a motivational sense, if you always consider from the optimistic point of view. So
right.
That's one of the things I remember is, you know, I was in the middle of the Kickstarter going like, oh, I don't know if it's going to make it. And they just said like, well, I should be positive about it.
Right. Or just like, just surrender. I think like mm-hmm. the idea that, you know, if you're holding to the outcome too tightly.
Right. Yeah. If it happens, it's good. If it doesn't happen, that's fine as well.
You right.
Know, yeah. Well, he surrendered, but he still had to catch the fish, you know.
Yeah, no, he never surrenders.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I think like a lot of it is about his body's involuntary will to survive,
yeah.
and how mm-hmm. that overcomes his reason and his optimism and whatever, and his pessimism and anything conscious about his experience.
Right.
Really, his body wants to keep living, so it makes him like fish and you know, keep breathing and stay afloat and
avoid that
train a tiger.
Right.
Well, yeah, it was interesting for me because I did the Kickstarter basically when I got laid off, right? And it was kind of this, I'd never done anything like that before, right? Previously, whenever I'd, you know, quit a job or been laid off, I'd go find another job right away.
Right.
Mm. So it was this kind of like, can you survive by yourself?
Mm. Yeah.
And there's a direct correlation there that says, like, can you do it? And I said, yeah, it worked. You know, I actually, like, survived by myself for this extended period of time.
Nice.
It's interesting because you survived by yourself with the help of everyone.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's great. Huh.
Yeah, that's a great way of thinking about it. So that's my what were.
Nice.
Mine's pretty quick. This was actually based off of a conversation we had on the last podcast. I watched the Spike Lee, I believe, Old Boy.
Hmm.
The American remake.
The American remake, right. Of this, what was it originally?
It was Korean.
Okay, yeah, that's what I thought. American remake of this Korean movie. It is a crazy movie,
huh.
But the there's some very unique action shots which I really appreciated watching, and kind of just as a game designer building an action game, you want to kind of like take in like how do you build in movement, how do you build in the sense of a kinetic punch. And the movie has a couple scenes that does do that really well. So it was a fun watch for me.
Yeah, that's funny. I haven't seen the remake, but the original one has this like long corridor fight, which is pretty famous in some circles, where he's just, you know, got a hatchet and there's like people on either side of a long hallway that are trying to kill him. And the camera is tracked out to the point where you see basically the whole hallway from the side, like almost as if it's super, super letterboxed.
Ooh.
And you just see the whole fight play out. And the camera goes left and right a little bit to accommodate the movement of the action, but it's pretty much this view of the whole hallway, and that's exactly how your game looks, Kiwan.
Yeah, no, it really is. It is basically a side scroller camera lock.
Yeah, exactly.
For these scenes, so
interesting. That's kind of reminds me of an interview that they once had with Jackie Chan about how, you know, how he kind of, you know, designs shots in his movies and how he sort of dislikes the new generation of like martial art directors because
they cut too much.
Yeah, exactly.
They go to close-ups.
Yeah, yeah. They don't explain the action.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
The worst is the first Batman movie, The Dark Knight. I guess The Dark Knight Rise. No, that's the last.
Dark Knight. I think is the first one. Yeah.
The Dark Knight.
The Dark Knight Begins.
Yeah, and you see like him fighting in some prison, and
oh yeah, uh-huh.
There's no way to tell who's winning, what's going on. It's just cut, close up of a hit, close up of a fist moving through midair.
Right,
like what the heck is going on? It's exactly the wrong way to shoot a fight scene.
Well, I mean, it if you have somebody who actually is a real martial artist, you wouldn't need the kind of filler, kind of detail shots, the close-ups. And that's what what Jackie Chan's point is that, you know, you kind of hire those people who are just, like, you know, learning enough about martial arts, they're actors, and so you have to cover. Anyway.
But, I mean, the other way to do it is, like, The Matrix, who actually used the same fight choreographer as Jackie Chan.
Right.
Oh, interesting.
Right. Like, yeah, they show you everything. King. Yeah.
And they just trained the hell out of Keanu Reeves until he was good enough to pull off those shots.
That's the only way, man. You have to walk the path.
Yep.
So, okay, very far from the topic of educational
that's
platforms
all right.
that are game focused and democratized.
Right.
We tangent sometimes.
Yeah, it's a good thing.
But
a good thing.
What are you guys
what are you guys up to?
Taking in.
Do you want to
sure. I'm reading a book called Story Engineering. I like the title, but it's, you know, I'm kind of a story geek, like plot and narrative and character and how do they work together and how do you create these experiences where you're invested in a character's journey. So story engineering is kind of a cool take on the physics of, you know, how do you build that kind of a structure.
Very interesting. I think that might be good stuff for a lot of game developers that are working on roguelike titles. Which right. You essentially kind of, you leave it to the systems to kind of procedurally build the story.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it'd be interesting to look at that and see how you could engineer better systems to create, you know, that
better
that
stories.
Type of narrative.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you still have to have that what if premise that hooks all the action in some way as the mm-hmm. obstacles escalate. So there is, you know, across storytelling and genres and games being one of them, you know, there's this. These systems, why does our brain want to follow people doing stuff and solving problems?
Yeah, cool. And what's the most satisfying sort of contour for the for that story
yep.
to take in terms of, like, I would say, for lack of a better word, arousal?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, you need, for example, people have found that you need a second act break.
Right.
Right.
Like, in the middle of the second act... Everybody, no, not the denouement, before this, that, where like, the hero's been beaten, and they just do nothing for a little while.
Right.
Yeah, maybe they even face death.
They lick their wounds.
Yeah.
Start a fire.
Before something catalyzes them to try again, and then that leads to the denouement.
Right.
But, but there's... It seems weird that you'd need, for a story to have a satisfying structure, you'd need the character to do nothing for a little while.
Right.
But it's true.
They're getting their muster. They're figuring out their inner strength that will lead them to the awesome Jackie Chan sequence,
true.
Which they
right.
annihilate.
Or they're building better mousetraps.
The audience needs a rest.
Yeah, sure.
Because presumably right before that, they've experienced some high of some emotion or other,
mm-hmm.
depending on the genre of the movie. But yeah, it takes a lot out of you, so you need to like relax for a
right,
minute.
Right.
And you can't, you know, if you don't take them down again, you can't bring them up again.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's only so high you can go.
Right.
Cool.
That's interesting.
That's what I studied in college, actually.
Oh,
like
yeah?
Screenwriting.
Oh, neat.
Oh, cool.
And Facade, if you guys have heard of the game Facade.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's sort of like AI-based conversational.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it has that curve programmed into it explicitly of, like, the chatbots get more, like, irritable and frustrated and whatever at certain points, like as you play through the game, it's at certain points in time. So there's like a timer running and they know like 40 minutes in, there's going to be like somebody's going to blow up at somebody else, even though it's not determined, it's not predetermined. They just like try and do that kind of story contour shaping algorithmically.
Yeah, I find that type of just, you know, you kind of have this curve, right? And you kind of put things in to match the curve. That's fascinating for me.
Mm.
Yeah.
It seems like UC San Diego is doing a lot of stuff with that. And actually, there's somebody at Northwestern who does that.
Oh, really?
Like procedural storytelling. Mm. I can't remember his name.
Interesting.
Anyway, that's very cool. I want to read that book.
Story. Yeah, we'll both have to check it out. We'll link it up, too.
Okay. Sorry, I don't know. I can't remember the author's name. But it's, like, on Amazon. But I'm sure you'll find it, Story Engineering.
Okay.
We will.
Your turn, Alat.
It seems that we're, you know, except for Kiwan, we're all, like, in book nerds. So I picked up a book rather recently.
Who reads? Come on.
Right? I just look at the pretty pictures.
Dead trees?
Yeah.
Exactly.
I like the cover design. So the name of the book is Reimagining. I'm a bit of a politics wonk. And this book is sort of a short read paperback called Reimagining Progressive Politics in the Age of Fantasy by, I believe his name is Stephen Duncombe. He's a professor at Gallatin University, New York. And it came out in 2007. I don't know if there's any significance to the year, but I think there might be. And his basic thesis is that part of the problem with progressive politics right now is there is this crisis or the fetishization of facts. Like, you know, if you tell the masses what's good for them, supported by data, they will be better informed and they'll make better decisions. And of course, we know that the reality is kind of not, you know, humans don't work that way. And so he kind of, you know, brings examples as seeds of inspiration for how to kind of excite the progressive base without beating them on the head with phone book thick of facts. And so he talks a little bit about, for example, why Las Vegas works so well, and what kind of primeval kind of emotions and desires Las Vegas appeals to that makes people want to go there, knowing fully well that what they're engaging in is complete fantasy. They know that it's fantasy, but they revel and relish and enjoy in being immersed in it. Another example that he brings up is, interestingly enough, so it's kind of just quickly, the other example that he brings up is Grand Theft Auto. I think San Andrea was the one that was out around the time of the publishing of the book. And how he talks about like how the game represents everything that he's against politically and intellectually, but he really enjoys the transgression and being someone else in the game, and how all the kind of the violence that he kind of you know perpetrates in the game is actually a sort of release. And so he kind of generally brings out all these case studies in how fantasy and appealing to emotion is a powerful tool to be used. He sort of he doesn't want to shy away from the facts, but he also wants people to kind of engage in story making as they do the activism that, you know, will make the world a better place.
Very cool.
For sure.
Yes, all right, well, We're just going to give a couple quick shout-outs to our sponsors. It is con season coming up here now that it's getting warm again. So if you would like to get 15% off any con material, that's prints, business cards, T-shirts, whatever, if you go to inoprints.com, you can get 15% off your first order with the code CGS for Chicago Game Entrepreneur Show. So whatever you need, 15% off your first order. And then we're kind of at the end of tax season, but it's never too late.
If you haven't done it now, yeah, you got to call.
You might be in trouble. But our friend Marty over at Ledger General specializes in small business taxes. Really, you don't know how great it is to have someone do your taxes until you don't have to worry about it. And then you'll be like, what was I doing for the rest of my life until I had a guy who takes care of my taxes for me? So anyway, if you're a small business owner, and I hope you are, if you're listening to this podcast, definitely give Marty a call. You'll get a free half-hour consultation if you mention the Chicago Game Entrepreneur Show.
Yeah, Ledger General.
Nice.
All right. So thank you guys so much for coming on.
Thanks.
It was really interesting talking. And, of course, your Kickstarter again is?
Planet Lab.
Planet Lab.
You can't miss it. It's
all right.
It's got a frog on the cover.
Exactly. Our mascot is a frog.
Thanks, cool. Guys.
And it goes until the
April 17.
Yeah, April 17. You can give us your tax return.
That's right. There's still time.
Right. If you go to Marty's.
Nice. Yeah. You get the tax return, you can put it toward a good cause.
Yeah.
That's great.
Get some extra karma points.
That's right.
Well, this was really fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
I really enjoyed the conversation.
I'm so glad. Yeah, I had a ton of fun as well.
Okay.
Cool.
Okay.
And thanks, everyone, for listening again.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks, listeners. Thanks, and everyone. Worlds. Good night.
Thanks for tuning in the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you'll be back again to share more stories from Sweet Home Chicago.